Call the next case, please. You may proceed.
May it please the court, my name is Charlie Marsh. I'm Marsh, I'm pleading, and I represent Mr. Turner in the case before the court. The case is about the use of a hearsay in an SVP civil commitment proceeding. There isn't much question about that it's hearsay. The Commonwealth in its brief admits that the prior diagnosis testimony is impermissible hearsay, and they don't claim a business record exception. They also concede that the criminal convictions and the treatment placement records are hearsay, but they claim a business record exception for that. Now, it's clear from the record that neither Probation Officer Pratt nor Dr. Hastings made the record from what they did in the proceeding.
Everything they testified to came out of the 1993 pre-sentence and transfer report, right?
That's
it's all
correct.
Confined to those documents.
That's correct.
But neither of those documents were actually admitted, right?
None of them were admitted. Okay. That's correct. This case is therefore distinguishable from the recent case that you decided in Smith, where therapists at DCVR made treatment records of how they treated the SVP, the sexual violent predator who was resident there. These fellows, Pratt and Hastings, did not make any of those records and were not involved in making the records. And what's more, Pratt admitted at Joint Appendix 95 that they collected this information. They did an investigation. Well, police officers do investigations, and they get a lot of information from other sources, but police reports are not admissible in evidence. The juvenile records that he talked about, that Pratt talked about, came from a different agency, and he admitted that at Joint Appendix 73. The heart of this case is, in my mind, whether it's harmless error. Clearly.
Before you get to that, let me ask you a question. Let me read a quote to you from Professor Friend on page 1036 of his 7th edition. And he says, where verification of recorded facts is not possible through personal knowledge of the record keeper, practical necessity requires admission of recorded evidence which has a circumstantial guarantee of trustworthiness due to the regularity of the record preparation and reliance on them by their preparers or those for whom they are prepared. Doesn't that fit this situation?
I don't think so, Judge. This is one step removed. In the ordinary business record case, take a bank record. The person who enters the record of the check does it one after another, all day long. There is no particular reason to question the reliability of that, simply because he is doing it one after another. That's not like a record, a PSI, that's prepared for litigation.
Well, that's also the duty of the probation officer to do that, and the instruction of the court that he go to the records and get this information.
I never understood why the fact that it was his duty to do so made any difference to the hearsay exception.
Well, it has to do with regularity, doesn't it? He would not go to ask the neighbors down the street if you know if he's got a criminal record or not.
There's no question that he does it regularly.
And he looks at.
But so do police officers.
He looks at criminal convictions that are recorded in databases regularly, too, doesn't he?
He does, but those are hearsay records, unless that agency did it. In this case, he admitted that he didn't go to his own agencies. He went to the juvenile agency to get that record. He does that at Joint Appendix.
And that's a regularly kept record, and in fact, your client had a chance to contest that when it was introduced against him at the trial, at his juvenile trial way back when. I mean, I guess I just don't. I'm stuck with the fact that is this sort of a gotcha? This is a loophole? Because I'm not concerned about this being accurate.
Well, then I think we say you might be arguing for a rule that says any state record or any record produced by a government agency is an accurate record.
I don't know about that, but this record, I'm not convinced about its accuracy. And it seems to be something that is used on a regular basis. The probation officers do it all the time. They go to these same records all the time. They're kept for the purpose of knowing what happened to people when they go to court, either juvenile court or adult court. They're like the poster child for regularly kept records.
Okay, but the PSI is made in preparation for sentencing hearing. The statute specifically says that PSIs and hearsay evidence is admissible in a sentencing hearing. Because okay. The statute says so, not because of any exception.
Okay.
Right? But we don't know what happened at the hearing, that sentencing hearing. We don't know because we don't have a transcript. Because
well, we know it's introduced into the record because that's how it gets there.
Yes, but we don't know whether the attorney challenged that record or not because we don't have a transcript.
Well, whenever I had one challenged, I would change the PSI if I agreed with the change.
But you're not required to change the PSI.
Okay. Why would I let an inaccurate document go into the record?
I challenge it. I say to the judge.
No, so why would I let it go in if it's inaccurate?
Well, that's the way it works. You go in, you testify. That's not accurate, Judge. Does the report get changed? No.
I think we're stuck with a disagreement. But you disagree with Friend, then, or you don't think this fits that?
I don't think that fits that particular case.
Why can this not be characterized as just the officer's reporting on his personal investigation in the case?
Same reason that you can't have a police officer. He does an investigation too, but we don't admit his evidence. Whatever he comes up with in his report, unless it's, of course, the statement of the defendant, we don't allow the police officer to report it. We didn't in Wynn or Lawrence, one of those SB cases, the police report was not allowed in. The probation officer stands in the same position as the police officer in that case. He's doing an investigation of what other people tell him.
But he's looking at records, official records. These are all, they may not be business records, but they're official records, aren't they? They're records kept by the Commonwealth.
We don't have a claim in this.
You don't have the record.
We have a claim of a business record.
Okay.
And that goes too far for a business record.
Can you tell me that part of Pratt's testimony was about the juvenile treatment records?
Yeah.
And that was in the juvenile pre-sentence report. But those were treatment records throughout his entire life as a juvenile?
I'm sorry?
The juvenile treatment records were compiled over a course of time.
I would assume. I have no way of knowing.
Okay.
I have no way of knowing. All I know is that Pratt says, I didn't get that record from my records. I got it from some other agency.
Well, counsel, let's try to move beyond the gotcha stage with this. What you're really objecting to is that the not opinion or something that's amorphous that appears in the pre-sentence report. What came in at the trial in this matter was his juvenile convictions and essentially where he was housed between 1988 and 1994.
Right.
And whether or not he had successfully completed treatment as a juvenile.
That's correct.
All of which are facts and are capable of being refuted if they are not in fact true.
We have no way of refuting most of it. Most of it occurred a very, very long way, a long time ago.
Your client knows what he was charged with back as a juvenile, does he not?
He may. It's a long time ago. Most of my clients don't remember what their records were.
If there is any real doubt about were you or were you not convicted as a juvenile or found to have committed a delinquent offense as a juvenile, if there's any doubt about whether you were housed within a juvenile facility, It can be determined from the contrary fact can be established.
It's not my burden. It's not Mr. Turner's burden to do that.
But if you look at the reason for the hearsay rule in the first place, it's to make sure that which comes in is in fact can be established, and the exceptions are generally for those where it's not really a matter of opinion, it's not really a matter of where there is any real doubt.
In the Lawrence case, you objected and reversed a case in which a whole set of facts that were hearsay came into evidence. Now, you're going to decide here, to me, it's a, what matters? What matters? Are these facts? Well, they weren't facts in the Lawrence case. We don't know if they're facts in this case because they're hearsay facts. They happened a long time ago, and there was no transcript because the court reporter is not required to keep a transcript.
There are so many hearsay exceptions, I don't even recall the exact number. Hearsay comes in all the time.
And the question before the court, I think, is how much do you want to let that rule just go away?
Well, it's not a matter of letting the rule go away. It's a matter of exactly what Justice Millett asked. Is there any reason to believe that that a juvenile record that appears to have been regularly kept is not accurate?
How do I challenge that? How do I challenge that? How do I get to, I don't have the person who made that juvenile record in the probation office, the juvenile probation office. How do I figure out who that guy is? How do I know if he's even around anymore?
You can subpoena the record for one thing.
I think you, as the attorney for the party whose record it is, if in fact it is not accurate, are capable of bringing that into the court.
I can think of multiple ways you can do it. But again, it's not my burden to prove the facts in the case.
They have just proven the facts. What you are trying to do is to indicate that their proof is insufficient, and you have not done so.
Well, I think my hearsay objection is what keeps it out.
Well, then now we're circular because I'm responding to your hearsay objection.
But if I can't rely on the fact that it's hearsay, then if the burden now shifts to me to go out and prove a bunch of facts.
No, the facts have been established unless you can dispute them.
They've been established by hearsay.
This has truly become circular. I have no further
questions. Let me ask you. You talked about Lawrence, and I don't think Lawrence is very much on point, because in Lawrence, we said that you couldn't use an expert witness who used information from police reports concerning various unadjudicated allegations of sexual misconduct in reference to his previous polygraph exam. That's not what we're talking about here at all.
That's right. You're exactly right. It's even worse here.
Oh, this is worse than that.
This is worse because what Dr. Hasten testified to was another diagnosis in the record. What was testified to in the Lawrence case were facts that were one step removed from the ultimate issue in the case. The ultimate issue in the case being we have a diagnosis of conduct disorder. Now, the jury is free, as you said in Lawrence, I think again, the jury is free to disregard that testimony, just disregard the expert, or discount his testimony. Now what's happened is we have an invisible expert who has also said, this guy has conduct disorder. And Hastings says, well, it's the same thing as what I said, and it's in the record. Now, that's not admissible under the Munn decision. But it is even more important than the other facts, because unadjudicated facts are facts about badness. Badness is not the ultimate issue in this case. The ultimate issue in this case is whether the man has a mental abnormality or personality disorder. You've just now allowed, if you allow this to go forward, you've allowed somebody to corroborate what Dr. Hastings is saying without him being subject to cross-examination. So it's frankly much worse because
Commonwealth has conceded that was inadmissible hearsay. Commonwealth conceded that
they
point?
Did.
So address what Justice Millett was asking to the PSR that included prior convictions and prior treatment. I understand your argument that the diagnosis that can't be confirmed should not be the basis for the doctor testifying. But what I believe what Justice Millett was asking you is you have prior criminal records that the probation officer has compiled to present the PSR. Why is that not have enough validity to it?
First of all, criminal records can be proved and should be proved by statute with a record conviction. You're asking me to go out and find all this stuff. It's not my burden in the first instance. Why isn't the AG, so supposed to go out and collect the records of conviction, certify them in court, and bring them in.
Well, but your client testified about past convictions. Your client testified about past convictions.
Some of them.
Okay. And the institutional infraction, the document was actually introduced, and there wasn't an objection at that time. So I think we really, this case narrows down in terms of the treatment, the juvenile treatment records, and Dr. Hastings' testimony that the Commonwealth concedes was inadmissible hearsay.
That's
and it's a question of whether it was harmless or not.
That's right.
So with regard to the juvenile treatment records, would you have had the same objection if the original juvenile probation officer were the person testifying as the custodian of those records and saying these are kept in the regular course of my department's function in supervising this juvenile, and it was the custodian of those original records?
I suppose it would depend on what those records contain. So, for example, if those records contain psychiatric diagnoses, yeah, I have a problem with that. But we don't know what they contain. You just said I found it in the juvenile record, which goes to another part of this case, which is, did you find evidence in the record of successful treatment, soliciting hearsay? Because it is hearsay. If I say no, I've just said, hey, there's no successful treatment. Forget treatment, successful treatment. If I say, did you find evidence in the record that Mr. Peacock killed the victim with a candlestick in the ballroom, and you say no, or you say yes, you're soliciting facts through the back door.
Right, I understand that. But also with regard to the whole notion of the business records and how you get those introduced, I mean, Mr. Pratt was saying that he was the custodian of these records that were compiled, but he wasn't the custodian of the records as they were originally made.
He was
one step removed from that original custodian.
That's correct.
Does that make a difference in
it
terms of business records?
It's just another step of hearsay, as opposed to my agency compiled these records. Probably.
This is how they're compiled. This is why we compile
them. Yes, this is how we compile them. So, for example, he could testify to the conviction, the adult conviction, no problem. That's his agency. But what he does is he's testifying to juvenile records that were not compiled. So it's another step removed. We don't know how reliable they are. If you allow that, I submit, you're promulgating a rule that says if it's a state agency, it's okay. I think my time is...
Actually, yes. Up. Yes. Your time has expired.
I mean, I'm happy to answer more questions.
Can I ask one more question? I'll give him the question you want. Why is it not harmless error?
Well, when you combine the extra diagnosis, the jury can reject the one. Is the jury apt to reject another diagnosis? It just confirms what the other fellow said. So that part to me is way beyond the pale of Lawrence. It's not just facts which are another step removed, which are facts of badness. General badness, as I said, not being the issue in the case. And when you combine that with the descriptions of the treatment record, which said psychiatric, Eastern States Hospital, a mental health facility, and you go through and you describe what they are, wouldn't a jury say, all those facts seem to me to say, the man's a psycho, we better put him away. So that's why I don't think it's harmless. You don't know what kind of impact, and I'm sure the Commonwealth will get up and argue, look, there are all these other facts that they can conclude from. But the ultimate issue is psychiatry, mental health, that's the ultimate issue. Whether he's a bad guy, that's not the issue.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Chief.
Sir, you can stay at this council table. Your rebuttal time's up, but you still get to sit there.
May it please the court, I'm Chris Obenchain, representing the Commonwealth in this matter. Given Turner's admissions, his testimony, and his concessions by his counsel, that Dr. Hastings' diagnosis of antisocial personality disorder was valid, any error caused by the admission of his statements was harmless and couldn't have influenced the jury's decision in this case.
Let's hone in on the testimony where Dr. Hastings says there was another diagnosis of this. Because I think part of the what he had to show that there was his prior history diagnosis of this condition before a certain age or over a certain period of time in order to qualify, to justify his diagnosis. So he's relying on this prior diagnosis.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Why is that harmless?
It's harmless error because Turner's counsel conceded in his closing argument that Dr. Hastings' diagnosis of antisocial personality disorder was a valid diagnosis. On page 233 of the appendix, he concedes that fact. He doesn't argue. In fact, he says, I'm not going to argue that he hasn't been diagnosed with antisocial personality disorder. And so he concedes the fact that the diagnosis is valid. And all of the statements that were objected to, all three of these statements, go directly to the juvenile record of Turner. The reason for introducing evidence of the juvenile record of Turner was to establish that he met the criteria of antisocial personality disorder, which requires a finding that there was evidence of conduct disorder prior to age 15. So when Turner's counsel concedes to the jury that the diagnosis of antisocial personality disorder is a valid diagnosis, that's harmless error.
What he said, is that really a legal concession? He says, I'm not going to argue that. That's a legal concession, you think?
Yes, Your Honor, because he goes on to say, what he says is, what I'm arguing is that it is that disorder that causes him to commit sexually violent crimes and makes him likely to do so again in the future. Essentially, there's kind of three parts of a finding that an individual is a sexually violent predator, that they've committed a sexually violent offense, that was conceded, that was admitted to even by Turner himself, that he has a mental abnormality or personality disorder, that was conceded, and then that disorder makes it difficult for him to control his predatory behavior and likely to reoffend. It's that third point that Turner's counsel focuses on in his argument in saying, this is why you shouldn't find him to meet this criteria, because his behavior has gotten better over the course of time and he's no longer likely to commit these kind of acts.
So I guess the question I had, though, by not arguing at other point in his closing, you think he conceded it? I know he didn't argue it, but I don't know whether that's necessarily a legal concession. That was my question. But you think it is. But go ahead.
Your Honor. I would say that is that he says to the jury, I'm not going to argue that he's been diagnosed with antisocial personality disorder. And there was no other expert testimony to refute that or anything of that nature. So he conceded that point, that diagnosis was valid.
Just by his statement that he wasn't going to argue. That's what you're basing on.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right.
And
have we ever used something that counsel said in closing argument to find that constituted an otherwise inadmissible evidentiary issue to be harmless?
I don't know that specific that a decision on point. I haven't found one, Your Honor, so I don't know the answer to that.
All right.
But I think the point is, even so, you know, Turner obviously, as Justice Mims pointed out, Turner had an opportunity to refute the facts that were introduced into evidence. Turner himself testified, and when he did testify, he admitted that he had committed his convictions that Dr. Officer Pratt testified to. And in addition, if we look at the statements of Dr. Hastings,
counsel, if Turner had not chosen to testify, were those facts that are capable of being established independently of his testimony?
The facts of his convictions?
Yes.
Yes, Your Honor. Okay. Officer Pratt, and I think, you know, the court focused on whether or not this was Officer Pratt's testimony was admissible as a business records exception. And I think clearly if you look at the jurisprudence on this issue, the court has said that the primary central consideration in a business records exception analysis is whether the information is reliable and trustworthy. That's what the primary analysis is. And in this case, we have, as has been pointed out, a probation officer doing his duty that he's statutorily required to do in terms of compiling this information. And it is different from a police report. It is distinguishable from that because the probation officer does have that statutory duty to collect the information and report it to the court. And just as businesses rely upon information that is transmitted from one to another, both the probation office and the courts rely upon these investigations, these reports, in, you know, doing their ordinary business.
Okay, well, let me ask you, if you've got records in a juvenile treatment facility, and it's doctor's notes, counselor's notes, all of that kind of stuff, those are the people who are making those entries, and there's someone in that, you know, facility who's the custodian of those. But when you have a probation officer who goes and gets them to put it into a pre-sentence report, and then you have a different probation officer who then takes the pre-sentence report and puts it into his records, how can the current person, Dr. Pratt, testify as the custodian of the original treatment records?
Well, Your Honor, that's the very rationale for the business records exception.
He doesn't even if he could, he doesn't testify to that. Show me anywhere in his testimony here he talked about that those treatment records were kept in the regular course of that treatment facility, entered, you know, in the routine business of that facility. Where does he say that?
Well, he doesn't, Your Honor.
Well, then how can they be admissible? I mean, he didn't even jump through the hoops. Even if he could do it, he didn't jump through the hoops here.
Well, Your Honor, the
did he? I mean, if I'm missing something in a testimony, show me.
I think what Officer Pratt did was establish that these records were prepared in the ordinary course of business.
And by so, him, for, as terms of compiling them. But let's look at the underlying record that he's compiling. He didn't testify to that. Whether he could or couldn't, I don't know, but he didn't.
I think it goes back to the question of whether those records were reliable and trustworthy. And so he testified that he received that information from Juvenile Corrections, that it was put in the transfer report, and that report was submitted to the court. The court relies upon that, as we noted in our brief.
But whoever said that the treatment records were kept in the regular course of business of that institution?
Your Honor, my reading of the business records exception is that it is the custodian of the record that is being sought to be admitted, which was the information from the transfer.
Well, under your theory, you could take a record generated here by some agency, and you could have this agency compiling them, then this agency compiling them. You could have 10 agents, you could have 10 layers of compilation, and the last person, if they're the ones who did the last compiling of the records, could testify as to all of them?
Your Honor, I think that the cases involving the business records exception indicate that the purpose is one of practical application, so that it's not necessary to bring in every single person along the way who has touched those records, provided there is a circumstantial guarantee of trustworthiness. And that, I mean, that language is included, and that's a determination for the trial court to make. And I think that's why the trial court limited the information that was allowed to come in to the bare facts of where he was housed in juvenile corrections and the convictions that he received.
Yeah, but it was more than that. They said there's no record that he successfully was treated for sex offender, successfully completed a sex offender treatment program.
And
that testimony is in there.
That testimony is in there. And
that's more than just like he was housed here from this period of time and he was housed here from this period of time. That's much more than that.
That testimony also came in through Dr. Hastings as well.
But if it's in the same record. Right.
But when Dr. Hastings testified about Turner's record history as far as sex offender treatment, he testified about it, and there was no objection when Dr. Hastings testified about that. So I would argue that even if that was hearsay,
but wasn't there a McMahon objection to Dr. Hastings' entire body of this testimony? There was there not?
to all of Dr. Hastings' testimony?
With Dr. Hastings' testimony with regard to the opinions of others, was the objection solely to the diagnosis that appeared, or was it broader than that?
With respect to his statement that there was a prior diagnosis, the objection was to that specific statement, that there was a prior diagnosis.
And you're saying that his testimony as to no successful completion of treatment as a juvenile was a distinct part of his testimony that was not objected to?
Yes, that was distinct from the information about a prior diagnosis. Okay. Those were two different parts of Dr. Hastings' testimony.
Let me follow up with a question on that. Dr. Hastings is your expert witness, is that correct?
That's correct.
He can certainly use information that is hearsay informing his opinion.
That's correct.
Was the objection, he's not supposed to testify about what the underlying information is on direct examination, correct?
Yes.
Was there ever an objection made that he was testifying improperly on direct examination to this underlying information that was the basis of his expert opinion? That would be under 8.01-401:1, I guess. Was that objection made by the defendant?
I'm not certain, Your Honor. I don't believe that specific objection was made. It was simply a hearsay objection that was made, that he was testifying to hearsay information. I don't believe it was made under the 8.01.
Not specific enough to let the trial judge know that he was trying to say he can't testify about this underlying information, I take it. Is that what you're saying? That the judge did not have a chance to understand that was his objection.
If he did not specifically say that, I would argue that's the
case. But he certainly referred to McMahon v. Tatum. Referred to McMahon v. Tatum in making his objection. Which has to do with the expert being able to testify about hearsay, right, on direct examination. That's what they talk about in McMahon.
About expert testimony, diagnoses of other experts. That's correct.
Oh, they talk about hearsay evidence being testified to by an expert on direct examination, and they say it's prohibited.
That's correct. That's okay. What McMahon v. Tatum says.
Okay.
Yes, Your Honor. I would distinguish this case from Lawrence. Lawrence was relied upon heavily by the appellant in this case, and Lawrence is clearly distinguishable from this case because that Lawrence dealt with unadjudicated allegations of criminal misconduct. And in this case, we have criminal offenses that that Turner ultimately admitted that he had committed that were accurate. And as I said before, with respect to Dr. Hastings' statements, all of those statements went to Turner's conduct as a juvenile. And that went to his diagnosis of antisocial personality disorder. And so when Turner concedes the point that the antisocial personality disorder diagnosis is valid, that is harmless error. That couldn't have affected the jury's decision as to whether he had antisocial personality disorder, because that's what the evidence of what he did as a juvenile went to. And beyond that, there was a lot of evidence from Turner himself about what his conduct as a juvenile was. He admitted assaulting the teacher in Beaumont Learning Center, which was a juvenile correctional facility. He admitted getting in fights as a youth in school. He admitted all of this conduct that he did as a juvenile. And so, as a result, this was certainly, even if it wasn't already conceded that the diagnosis was valid, it was harmless in respect to all of the other evidence that came in regarding his conduct as a juvenile. And for those reasons, we would ask the court to deny the appeal.
All right. Thank you. You used all your time. Call the next case, please.